You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
So we have one more panel before a final break, and as the panelists come up, please feel free to take your one more panel before a formal break. If you want to take a break now, please feel free to do so, but we're going to keep moving forward. I want to start by saying I've twice failed, since we're talking a lot about a lot of failures, I've twice failed to mention both an important person here, Leti Davalos, who is in the Governance Studies program and has helped put this event together, and Leti is here, and her request of us that we help on social media. So the hashtag above my head, FinCrisis, is the one that we're using for this event, and I've been following it and terrific comments. And we're now getting into a core set of questions around regulation. There were already some questions around that throughout in the Peter Orszag session and even into this session. This next panel is going to look at what policies have been implemented, what regulatory changes came out of the crisis, and where do we stand today? And again, we have just another spectacular panel of experts to walk us through it. Peter Conti Brown from the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, who is a financial historian and legal scholar. Jonathan Macy, who is the Sam Harris Professor of Corporate Law, Corporate Finance, and Securities Law at Yale University. And then two dear colleagues of ours, Paul Mahoney, who is the David and Mary Harrison Distinguished Professor and the former Dean at UVA Law School, whose research areas include securities regulation and corporate finance, and our moderator, the John Battle Professor of Law at the University of Virginia School of Law, Julia Mahoney, who's going to moderate this panel, who is herself an expert on government finance, constitutional law, and nonprofit organizations. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Julia.
Thank you very much. As I think all of you in this room know, in the years leading up to the financial crisis, there were vigorous, ongoing debates about how and to what extent and in what ways the government should attempt to regulate the financial sector. Those debates have only intensified, and here with us today are three people who are going to help us make sense of all of this. First up, Paul Mahoney.
So, thank you. So this is an academic panel. We are not going to have insights to offer you. We're going to go a little bit more abstract. And to put the post-crisis regulatory reforms in context, I want to identify three basic strategies for dealing with instability in the financial system. So strategy one is structural. The idea is to constrain banks so much through capital requirements, limits on their activities, maybe even limits on their size, so that systemic financial crises are all but impossible. And this involves a trade-off. You're trying for maximum stability, but there is a risk of getting lower growth if these constrained banks cannot meet the economy's needs for credit. Strategy two, I will call the Andrew Mellon strategy in honor of his advice to President Hoover, and that is to simply let market discipline work. So the idea here is that when there is a widespread liquidity crisis, those banks and businesses that can't meet their obligations should be allowed to fail, and the stronger institutions should buy their assets for pennies on the dollar and earn enormous returns in the process of getting the economy back on its feet. This, too, involves an obvious trade-off. You are trying for higher growth, but you could get lower stability. And then the third strategy is to have a government-sponsored lender of last resort. And here the playbook was written by Walter Badgett, and the idea is that the bank lends freely to banks that have temporary liquidity needs. Here the trade-off is that you're shooting for both growth and stability, but you have a risk that the latter will be undercut by moral hazard. In a financial crisis, the line between illiquidity and insolvency becomes blurred, and knowing that, banks will be tempted to take excessive risks in good times in hopes of being bailed out should times turn bad. Now, the U.S. has used all three of these strategies at different times in our history. Now, none has been completely durable over the long run because, as I mentioned, each has costs associated with it. And when those costs become evident, political support tends to become more challenging. So the National Bank era was an attempt to implement strategy one. So banks were allowed to issue banknotes, but only if fully collateralized by treasury bonds. There was also an assumption that banks would limit their lending to so-called real bills or short-term self-liquidating commercial loans. Well, that turned out not really to be the way the system worked. Post-Civil War America had a very capital-hungry economy, and banks ended up making long-term commercial and real estate loans and investing in corporate securities. And the real bills concept was never made a formal legal requirement precisely because of the fear that you would not get enough growth if you did it that way. So that meant that by the early 20th century, the United States had restricted banks enough to create an inelastic currency that didn't really meet the economy's needs, but it hadn't restricted them enough to rule out systemic financial crises. And, of course, we did have a systemic financial crisis in 1907, about which Dean Bruner has written the definitive book. And more or less by default, that crisis was resolved through the Andrew Mellon strategy. The banks that had strong balance sheets, J.P. Morgan foremost among them, were in a position to and did dictate terms to weaker banks and profited by doing so. Well, that turned out not to be politically popular either. So the Panic of 1907 ultimately led to the creation of the Fed and the adoption of Strategy 3, the lender of last resort strategy. Well, the Fed has had to confront two global financial crises. In the first, the Great Depression, the Fed made very sparing use of its powers, and the result was a massive political backlash against the entire financial system. In the more recent financial crisis, the Fed made aggressive use of its powers, and the result was a massive political backlash against the entire financial system. So you see the political problem here. Public outcry about bailouts led Congress to at least say that in Dodd-Frank, it was moving back in the direction of Strategy 1. Okay, so capital requirements were boosted. We introduced stress tests, living wills, and liquidity ratios. So, and then we also, of course, restricted bank activity through the Volcker Rule. But it's important to note that, in fact, we haven't gone nearly as far in the direction of Strategy 1 as one would actually need to make financial crises a thing of the past. I can't tell you what capital ratio that would require, but let's just say 50% of bank assets. Well, that's not on the table, and it's not on the table precisely because of concerns about availability of credit. For non-bank institutions, the Dodd-Frank Act claims more or less to be adopting Strategy 2. The Fed's emergency lending powers were curtailed in Dodd-Frank, And Dodd-Frank also introduced a so-called orderly liquidation procedure that is intended to make financial discipline work for non-bank systemically important financial institutions or non-bank SIFIs. Well, as someone with libertarian leanings, I'm attracted to the Andrew Mellon strategy. But and indeed, one can't make too much of obviously of three data points. But I will note that we did have a V-shaped recovery from the 1907 crisis. We had a much more rapid and robust recovery from the 1907 crisis than either the Great Depression or the Great Recession. However, the Andrew Mellon strategy is plagued by what economists would call a time inconsistency problem. Everyone's in favor of market discipline when we're not in a crisis. But when we are in a crisis, it's very, very easy to simply abandon the strategy. I think one of the most pungent observations made during the period that the last panel was talking about was a quip by Barney Frank that the free market solution lasted for one day. It was the Monday of the Lehman Brothers failure, and then on Tuesday, the Fed stepped in to rescue AIG. So the conclusion that I would draw is that, look, it's easy to say after a crisis, we're never going to do this again. We are never going to put public money into an organization like AIG again. Very easy to say when the crisis is over, much harder to say when the next crisis rolls around. So in my opinion, we're still in a strategy three lender of last resort type world. I think the Fed will still be an extremely important player in the next financial crisis, and therefore I think Congress will come to regret having curtailed the Fed's emergency lending powers, because that will put Congress squarely in the hot seat the way it was with respect to TARP. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, Professor John Macy.
Thank you. It's great to be here. I'm not a frequent visitor to Brookings, but I do benefit tremendously, particularly by the writings, literature that I read by Brookings affiliates on the financial crisis. And some of my remarks will be, but not certainly not all, will be informed by some of those insights. So we've been invited on this panel to talk about, give a retrospective view of how we did during the financial crisis, and I want to think about that in four different, slightly different ways in my brief time with you this morning. One is how does particularly Dodd-Frank kind of stack up in terms of our kind of state-of-the-art thinking about the legislative process, et cetera. We heard during the first panel something I think is very true, which is that with respect to TARP, there was a tremendous feeling of crisis. This wasn't the New Deal. This was the Cuban Missile Crisis. People had to act very, very quickly. And so to that extent, one can certainly should not use the benefit of hindsight too much. On the other hand, Dodd-Frank, I would suggest to you, from a legislative point of view, very different in that the kinds of policies that are reflected in Dodd-Frank were not drummed up in the heat of the moment. They'd been sitting on the shelves of think tanks like this one and others, and had been thought of as policies that simply we weren't able to, we lacked the political will, we weren't able to transform these notions, the ideas of stress tests and living wills and the Volcker rule and liquidity ratios and the skin in the game regulations that I'll talk about. So I think it's not entirely fair of me, but not entirely unfair to sort of hold Dodd-Frank up to a slightly higher analytical standard, even with the wisdom of hindsight, than we might hold, say, TARP. So with respect to that, I'd say Dodd-Frank gets a kind of a decided C minus D plus as a piece of legislation that we can think about, you know, how much we've learned in political science, how much we've learned in political theory since the Great Depression, and knowledge about things like behavioral economics, behavioral finance, things like the Hayekian contributions about the nature of knowledge and information in the economy, and of course public choice. These three kinds of data points are kind of fairly poorly reflected in the legislation. I would say there are some bright spots. So, for example, I think, you know, a core cause of the financial crisis was this disjuncture between risk and rewards, and the failure of incentives in market processes. In particular, that we had these mortgage brokers, it's well known in retrospect, who would turn around and sell mortgages to pool sponsors, who in turn sold securities based on those loan pools. Dodd-Frank requires, with a strong nod towards understanding incentives, that these loan pools would retain approximately 5% of the risks of the loan. Unfortunately, as I don't know if Bob Posen is here, but as he pointed out in a very good March 2018's Brookings Institution publication, these so-called skin in the game, in quote, requirements have been eviscerated, that regulatory agencies have issued rules with broad exemptions for brokers and regulators have also watered down the requirements for the other main exemptions applicable to the small portion of U.S. home mortgages not backed by FHA, Fannie Mae, or Freddie Mac. So kind of, in my view, a bright spot in Dodd-Frank of being kind of cutting edge, thinking about the interplay of incentives with regulation that we don't see in many of these other aspects of Dodd-Frank have been lost. With respect to all of Dodd-Frank, it's hard really to generalize, but it's not too far off to say we created massive new bureaucracies with Dodd-Frank, and we are trusting those bureaucracies to do a good job in two different ways. Number one, to do a good job in drafting regulatory blueprints and filling out the vast amount of discretion given to these regulatory agencies, and then also in implementing the regulations. Now, I kind of follow Paul a little bit in having libertarian tendencies, but I have to say, in all honesty, the regulations have done the regulators thus far, as we sit here in 2019, have done a pretty good job. If you look at the quality and quantity of the stress tests, certainly in the United States, as distinct, say, from the European model, these stress tests are rigorous, and I think they do provide a fairly clear, good understanding of how much risk tolerance U.S. financial institutions face. We could see from the European template that this is not necessarily the case. It's possible to use gamesmanship and approach these stress tests in a strategic way. So there's nothing There's nothing in the form of kind of a foregone conclusion about stress tests to suggest he's going to work out well. As Paul also mentioned, capital requirements, very important, a real, true, genuine source of strength. Banks are very well capitalized, but these outcomes, while commendable, hold true kind of at the moment. And there's nothing to say that in the future there won't be variances, as we've seen in the past, with respect to implementation slippage and gaps in regulation. So one way to think about Dodd-Frank is to think about the legislation. It's very much a trust your regulator kind of statute, which makes me a little bit nervous. I don't think it's particularly state of the art. Having said that, I get to my second point, which is it's very easy for me as an academic to sit up here and criticize Dodd-Frank. What would I have that would be better, as opposed to what that would be legislatively feasible? And the answer is probably not much, to be perfectly honest with you. Certainly having greater risk-based deposit insurance payments, having more skin in the game, would have been better. But in retrospect, I think an honest appraisal, as much as it gets some of my ideological proclivities to say this, but to be frank, I think that these statutes have been thus far. Have been enormously successful. That's not to say that we may not have another, that we're not going to have another financial crisis. We have not improved our technical abilities at identifying bubbles and predicting bubbles. When the next financial crisis occurs, it is going to be a matter of finding, frankly, kind of heroic people who, as the previous couple of panels have described, were willing to sacrifice their short-term political welfare for doing things that may be deeply unpopular in terms of jump-starting the economy. Third thing that I want to get to is to think a little bit about the consequences. What were the consequences? And this was something that the first panel addressed just for a moment. Somebody raised the question that's really been plaguing me for the last several years, now that we're in the middle of the Trump era, if you will. And that is, to what extent does the sort of get out of jail free card, the fact that JP Morgan Chase, Citibank, AIG, Wells Fargo, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, large U.S. financial institutions were viewed as the major beneficiary of these statutes. The fact that many people viewed the bailout as a sort of a quid pro quo. A questioner addressed this briefly after the last session, which is in exchange for this bailout, the banks would engage in some self-restraint with respect to bonuses, some self-restraint with respect to freeing up lending in the economy, maybe more aggressively pursue CRA kinds of initiatives, and to the extent that there was a kind of implicit bargain, if you will, which I think there was in the passing of these statutes, an implicit bargain between the private sector, major banks, and the government as the perpetuator of the bailout. I think it's fair to say that the private sector did not and is correctly viewed as not kind of living up to their side of this implicit bargain. But that's the problem with an implicit bargain as opposed to an actual bargain. There was no actual quid pro quo, and these bankers are insulated from the political process and retribution. So the retribution has come towards political actors. And there's a very strong sense that that there's been a tremendous lack of accountability. One way of thinking, and this is my last point that I'd like to make, one way of thinking about the relationship between TARP and Dodd-Frank is that Dodd-Frank was supposed to be an accountability statute. It was marketed and sold to the American public as something that says, well, we've given TARP, we've given lots of monetary stimulus to the economy. Now we're going to have some payback in the form of greater regulation. These regulations are a fixed cost. They turned out to be a tremendously large motivating factor in terms of consolidating the financial sector, and they have acted as a barrier to entry. We see very little entry into the finance sector and a tremendous amount of consolidation at the top. And I think there's a lot of hostility and animus. I think it's a very important question. I don't purport to have the answer. I'll leave you with this, which is how much is Dodd-Frank and the bailout to blame for the fact that Donald Trump is in the White House? And I can't quantify it, but I'll leave it. I think it is some, and that is, I think, the greatest kind of indictment of the financial crisis reforms is that at an emotional level, there has not been a final accounting of people who were thought to be responsible, and I think that's had real consequences. Thank you.
Thank you. Our final panelist is Peter Conte Brown.
Thank you so much. There we go. Thanks so much, and thanks so much to Brookings and the Miller Center and UVA for hosting us on this great discussion. I want to talk a little bit about a revolution that's been occurring in central banking. There's been a revolution that's been was initially called the Quiet Revolution by Alan Blinder when he wrote about this in 2004. But has now been quite loud and intentionally so, and that's a revolution about transparency, right? And indeed, we normally date the transparency revolution in central banking to roughly the early 1990s. Keep in mind that when Ben Bernanke first stood before a gaggle of the press to have a post-FOMC meeting, it was the first Fed presser. It was the first Fed presser that had occurred since 1979, so this was indeed about breaking new ground, and that's in 2011. In the early 1990s is when we first get the logic of transparency that's so familiar to all of us now, that drives market reactions and Twitter mania and even some dyspepsia from our president, and that is releasing a public decision followed by minutes, followed on a lag of 5 years, with transcripts of the Federal Open Market Committee's decisions. So all of this is relatively new, right? And the idea behind transparency in central banking is older than the 2008 financial crisis, much older than 2008. Indeed, Paul invoked the good name of Walter Badgett, and Walter Badgett's book, Lombard Street, is a classic in the Mark Twain sense. Everyone cites it. Almost no one has read it. Paul has read it. I can tell you. He's a serious historian. Most people have not. And indeed, although Badgett's dictum, which you might be familiar with, the idea that banks should lend freely against good collateral at a penalty rate, Badgett never said that. That came much later. People were hoping to invoke authority by his name. He does talk, as Paul mentioned, about how a central bank should respond in a crisis. But most of that book, written in 1873, is about transparency in central banking. It's about the ways that these unique and uniquely powerful institutions can and must make themselves legible to the markets and societies that they serve. Now, transparency that comes to us by way of the 1990s and beyond, with more with transcripts and more speeches and changes in communications and post-crisis forward guidance and all of these things, these are seen as tools in the monetary policy toolkit. Let me be specific about what I mean here. Meaning, how do you change inflation expectations in a marketplace short of engaging in open market operations? In other words, it's a way to navigate monetary policy making at the zero lower bound. And so being transparent here is about credibility, and it's about locking in market expectations. And there's a vast literature, and there have been many events, even here at Brookings and Brookings Papers, exploring the monetary aspects of transparency. But transparency plays two roles when we're talking about central banking. So first, it's as a monetary policy tool, but then it's second, it is as a profound and important mechanism of democratic accountability for institutions that by institutional design we have said should be insulated from precisely that kind of accountability. All right. So this is all by way of background. Central banks know this. The public knows this, Congress knows this, and there are all kinds of mechanisms to shove, especially post-crisis, the Fed a little bit more into the spotlight, and sometimes the Fed itself is moving in that direction. But I want to read to you a statement out of that very famous meeting that we just got, the blow-by-blow from some of those participants. And that is, following that meeting, Barney Frank made this statement, and it shows up as a as an epigram on all kinds of crisis-related literature. And it's this. Barney Frank says, after hearing about the Fed's plans for AIG to send $85 billion, right, to stave off bankruptcy, and then simultaneously asking for the Congress to move swiftly to reinforce the Treasury and continuing those kinds of maneuvers, Frank says to Bernanke, do you have that? Do you have enough money to do the thing that you're describing with AIG? He says, do you have $85 billion? And Bernanke responds, we have $800 billion. And so his answer that gets quoted all the time, and is an important quote, says, well, no one in a democracy, unelected, should have $800 billion to dispense as he sees fit. Right? So this really represents kind of this reckoning for the Fed around transparency and authority and democratic legitimacy. What's often cut off, though, is the rest of that quote, which was cited at the time in the New York Times and then gets often forgotten. And this is, again, that we're talking about the AIG loan. This is what Barney Frank says about Bernanke. He can make any loan he wants under any terms to any entity or individual in America that he thinks is economically justified. What I find so fascinating about this quote is that it has no relationship to the Fed's own understanding of its legal authority, because just days before it had said, we cannot make that loan to Lehman Brothers. And in the weeks after the fact, there's not a lot of contemporaneous public evidence that they were thinking along legal terms at the time, but after the fact, when questioned about this, Bernanke and many others would say, we could not move to save Lehman because we were legally forbidden to do so. And what I think is so puzzling about this as a scholar of the Federal Reserve Act is that I think that that's wrong. That's an incorrect conclusion of the law. That I think the law as written by Congress is more capacious than the Bernanke Fed has supposed. That there might be very good policy. There might be very good political reasons for not there might be very good economic reasons for not allowing Lehman to receive the same treatment as AIG. But the idea that there would be a legal prohibition, I think, is incorrect. I've had this debate many times with the Fed lawyers who disagree with me, and we can talk about that in the Q&A. My main contention here, and in just the couple minutes I have left, I might mention a few other areas where this has been, where the Fed has simply not allowed the transparency revolution to take root, is that we never got to see the analysis that would allow us to take confidence that the Fed's own interpretation of its legal authority is the correct interpretation, right? Now, for lawyers, the way that we do this is by the oxymoronic brief, right? Briefs are not usually very short, right? You write your legal at length, your justification for a legal position. But the Fed doesn't litigate, not much. It does litigate a little bit at the boundaries on enforcement actions and some regulatory actions, but even there, the Fed does substantially less than that than, say, the EPA or even the SEC. But for most of the important questions in central banking, they're not subject to judicial review. And even Dodd-Frank's innovations around orderly liquidation, which involves the Fed, it's primarily for the FDIC, but the Fed is certainly involved. What judicial review has been imposed is can't be real. I mean, it's 24 hours for the district court to give a thumbs up or a thumbs down about whether or not the action was arbitrary and capricious. Meaning, we don't get that. We don't get to see the Fed explain itself, its interpretations of its statutes. And I think that is a very serious problem. I'm not saying that we should substantially expand, we should subject any FOMC decision to what the D.C. Circuit might say is wise or unwise about the direction of monetary policy. That doesn't sound like a good way to run a monetary system at all. So I don't think we should make any kinds of changes about how we litigate these issues. But I do think that the Fed's lawyers should join in the revolution and make themselves much more transparent, not only about legal conclusions, where they say, we have the authority to do X, or we're legally forbidden from doing Y, but to give reasons. And why do we give reasons? Well, sometimes it's just to satisfy a curious mind. But for many reasons, it'll be so people like me and John and Julie and Paul and people like you can say, I don't read the statute that way at all. I think you do have the legal authority to do this thing, so you must have other reasons for wanting to avoid it. Or, I don't think you have the authority that you propose to have. Let me give you a quick example of each of those. So the first, the Fed lacks a legal authority, so it says, with no analysis. And here we're talking about a kind of international bugaboo, which is nominal negative interest rates. Right. These have been a tool in the toolkit for other central banks, but not the Fed. Now, why? Now, one reason might be all freaking hell would break loose if all of a sudden the Fed announced that you have to pay for the privilege of depositing your funds with your local bank. Right? That's probably a fair political assessment we should have asked the earlier panel. But the reason given in FOMC minutes and then in a post, a Brookings post actually, by Ben Bernanke, was that it's illegal. The Fed can't. I'm working on a piece with Miles Kimball, co-authored piece, where we're explaining that's not true at all. The Federal Reserve Act is written in a way where the Fed controls a regulatory rate with substantial discretion. There has to be justification for it, but here's why we think it is perfectly legal to do so. But when I submitted a FOIA request to see that staff memorandum where it says the staff has said that it's illegal for us to do this, I said, oh, I'd like to see that. I was denied. I've been denied so many times in these FOIA requests to the Fed. And if there's time, let me tell you a story that I think FOIA, I think, is actually absolutely an area for ripe reform for the Fed. So that's one where the Fed says it has no legal authority. I think they're wrong. And at the very least, I'd just like to see their explanation so we can fight about it. So we can see, maybe I've got the better of the argument, maybe they do. But right now I'm shadowboxing, and you are shadowboxing if you want to challenge them on this question, because we have no idea what their ideas are. And again, you might hate the idea as a policy mechanism, but isn't it important for us to know what the Fed's authority actually is, what its boundaries are, and where we can get a sense of here's where it's unequivocally true is a boundary, here's a muddy middle. The law deals with both of those areas, but not with respect to the Federal Reserve, because again, we can't know what they think. So here's an example where I think they've asserted legal authority where there's none to assert. In the United States, we have what is technically called a crazy banking system, right? I was about to use profanity, but again, we're in a distinguished crowd. No other banking system in the world looks like ours does. There are a lot of different reasons for this, but one of them is that it's called a dual banking system. You can go to a variety of different governmental entities to receive a bank charter, whether you're going to be a credit union or a thrift or a national bank or a state bank, right? But Congress has designated certain parties within government as a charter giver. The Fed's not one of them. And yet it has asserted that authority in two recent instances. And I wrote a piece for Brookings This isn't a free advertisement for Brookings. They just have a lot of the good stuff. So I was trying to invoke them so many times. I wrote a piece for Brookings saying that recently the Fed said that one new bank that wants to arbitrage around the Fed's unique monetary policy right now can't do it. It can't receive access to the financial system because they don't like that policy. And then there was a credit union in Colorado that wanted to service marijuana-related businesses. The Fed said, no, we're not on board with that because marijuana is still illegal under federal law. Where in the statute does it get that they have that authority? We have no idea. We didn't until the marijuana credit union sued them, and then the Board of Governors filed an amicus brief, and this is the last insult to injury. They don't even put the amicus brief on their website. I had to find it from somebody else. And there we finally, refreshingly, get a legal accounting that I think is still false. But again, at least we know what they're thinking. And so I think here what the trauma of the 2008 crisis and its aftermath taught us was that we need, we long for, and we must have, and the Fed agrees, more transparency around these unique institutions. The revolution has stopped short of law, and I think that revolution should continue.
Thank you, and thanks to all our panelists for a terrific discussion. We have some time for audience questions, so please raise your hands high, and there will be mics coming around to...
Hi, I'm Colin Johnson. I just had a question about a little different regulation. So I believe in the 90s, Glass-Steagall was repealed. It's kind of separating the more speculative parts of investment banking from commercial banking. I wasn't around then, so I don't really know. But I guess, do you think, and it's a little speculative, but do you think that could have perhaps contained some of the systemic risks we saw with like the fall of Lehman and other banks and financial institutions in 2008?
I'm going to jump in there right there only to say that we have the world's leading expert on this question in Paul Mahoney, who's just written a fabulous, very detailed article on exactly this point. So you should all look it up.
So what I'll say just very quickly is, no, I don't think that the Glass-Steagall repeal had really much of anything to do with setting the stage for the financial crisis. And in one way of maybe thinking about this without going through the very detailed arguments that I've made elsewhere is to say, you know, there's a kind of conventional wisdom that banks have become too much like investment banks, engaged in too much securities activity. I think if you look at what actually happened on the ground in the crisis, the problem was exactly the opposite, that investment banks had become too much like commercial banks. They were funded increasingly with extremely short-term runnable debt that was financing securities, but securities that were at the more illiquid end of the spectrum, that didn't have extremely thick trading markets, as the as Bear Stearns and Lehman and others discovered to their dismay when they had to sell a lot of them. And it is a little bit ironic that one of our responses to the crisis, the Volcker Rule, removes even more liquidity from those very markets. So no, the short answer is I don't think the Glass-Steagall repeal has can really be attributed as a cause of the crisis.
Hello, my name is Bettina Daniel, and I'm a novelist. Ray Dalio has recently said, and some other people today have kind of echoed this, that capitalism isn't working for most Americans, although it's obviously working for him, and that he further says the wealth opportunity gap constitutes a national emergency, and he says, and this is kind of on the transparency note, that if the government should that the government should create metrics that literally judge the conditions of people. And here he invoked the study that one of the regional feds did that said that a lot of Americans would have trouble coming up with $400 without selling something. So my question to you all is, you know, imagine you're the on the blue ribbon panel that's been put together to suggest such metrics, these metrics that might literally judge the conditions of people. What kind of metrics might you suggest, and should those metrics be come up with and gathered and promulgated by the BLS or by the Fed?
Peter, do you want to opine on whether that the Fed's...
Well, I think that the premise of your question is right on, that tying this back to the kind of the financial crisis regulation, I think that there has been a strong feeling that the government was extremely responsive to the fragility of financial institutions in an epic and historical way, and has been entirely unresponsive to the needs of middle-class families and the growing gap in wealth and income. I don't know that metrics is the right way to go about this, but I do think that there's a there's an urgent need that this perception of lack of opportunity and basic unfairness be addressed, and I think that the success of the Trump campaign is really a strong reflection of a pushback against elites, and I do think this should be our number one focus of policymaking and policy thought.
Let me respond to the very last bit that you said, which is, you're putting your finger, obviously, as John says, on one of the most important questions in political economy. And the very idea that we would say, okay, so Fed, get involved, right? Fix this thing. Right? You're the Fed, right? And I think that is a very common reaction over the Fed century. It's had a virtually one-way ratchet in terms of the expansion of its authorities. We can have a good debate about whether or not a central bank should have such a significant role to play in small bank supervision. But I think that we should be extremely wary of expecting from our central bank to be everything at all times. I think that for one reason, because it simply doesn't have the tools to respond to some of these things. We're seeing this very directly. It was not given in Dodd-Frank the only role in resolving financial stability, though the Fed itself wanted that role. That was passed over to someone else. The Financial Stability Oversight Council, assisted by the Office for Financial Research. There's a credible argument that those two offices are no longer on the beat for financial stability. And there's good evidence that the Fed sees itself then as we're the last best hope for this. And so as it builds those expectations, but it lacks some of those tools, again, were given elsewhere, I think we're going to hit a buzzsaw in the next financial crisis where our expectations are that the Fed will solve this. As Paul alluded earlier, we've not given them necessarily the tools to do just that thing, and that disconnect, that should worry us.
My name is Steve Adams. I'm a corporate finance consultant. So I'm a little bit interested from the business side of things. As you think about corporations' ability to recession-proof, what are things that corporate leaders, if they have the foresight to see a recession coming, can do? Things like, you know, improving working capital, deleveraging. What are things that corporations can do to prepare better?
Well, I think I'm going to start with banks, even though you asked about corporations, because I think the principle is very similar. As academics, it's sort of our job to be critics, and when we've been kind of critical of Dodd-Frank. One thing that Dodd-Frank does that I think is fantastic, and I think it doesn't get enough credit for, is it introduced The notion that the Fed should consider what are called countercyclical capital buffers. And the idea is that when the economy is heating, the Fed now is encouraged to increase the amount of required capital. And when we're in a recessionary period, that gives it room to decrease it. I think that's incredibly important because regulatory policy is unfortunately strongly pro-cyclical. It tends to turn the screws on banks when the economy is doing poorly, which is a terrible idea, and then loosen up when the economy is overheating, which is an equally terrible idea. I'm a little disappointed that the Fed hasn't made more use of that authority, but in an ideal world, managers of banks and businesses would do this themselves. They would look at the current state of the economy and say, you know, we're pretty far along into an expansion. It's time to build up a capital buffer, because I can imagine in late 2019, sometime in 2020, sometime in 2021, I'm going to really want to have that additional capital cushion.
Peter or John, do you want to add anything to that?
Well, the reality is that in times of recession, the scarce commodity of capital becomes even scarcer. And as Paul was suggesting in his answer, we all become at the mercy of the financial system, as we saw as we slowly rolled out of the financial crisis of 08 and 09. And to a large extent, companies are at the mercy of their lenders, and that's why I think Paul's response is very apt, to that we have to focus on the banking system and the incentives that we provide for countercyclical action.
Tom Jennings, retired UVA law school graduate. One thing that we put off in the crisis of 08 was how to deal with Fannie and Freddie. Which of Professor Mahoney's three approaches should we take in dealing with them, or is there a fourth way to deal with them?
So to understand the problem of Fannie and Freddie, we need to identify exactly the ways that governmental policy may or may not be distorting incentives, right? And then thinking through what the political economy of those resolutions must be. Right? Academics do like building castles on clouds and sort of assuming that elegant legislative solutions. But Fannie and Freddie, I think, as a financial historian, we've got to really understand where the incentives are for reform and what the consequences will be of lack of reform. So to unpack that a little bit, we just need to understand what those institutions and related institutions are and what incentives they create throughout the marketplace and what that means. So Fannie and Freddie became the heart of the financial crisis in some sense because of the way that they, by participation and setting standards, and then especially through their balance sheet by purchasing securitized prime mortgages, pushed interest rates lower than they would otherwise be, which expands, obviously, the amount of housing stock that's being purchased on leverage by homeowners throughout the United States. Right? Now, this is not the only cause of the financial crisis, but it's a significant factor for sure. So what do we want then instead? Well, one would be just abolish the things, right? So let people be able to convince counterparties that they're a worthwhile credit risk so that they can get into a long-term relationship with their bank on the basis that the market will permit. Now, there's a good argument in favor of this. There's nothing written in, Moses didn't bring on a tablet a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage, right? This is an innovation of the United States. Other countries don't follow it. I heard a murmur of dissent. Is that an 11th commandment that I wasn't aware of? But note well that the couple of times when people have even played with the idea in congressional hearings, bipartisan ire. I'm the beneficiary of an extremely attractive long-term mortgage rate that is directly a result of Fannie and Freddie. As an academic, I think it's appropriate for me to think about these things. But as I look at that rate and I look at my monthly balance sheet and obligations, I think Oh, hell yes, let's keep this. This is delicious, right? And because my reaction is that way, and Republicans and Democrats' reactions are the same ways, we've got to think through then, what are the incentives for changing that reform, and what is the thing that you find so offensive? And again, these are had been pushed off the balance sheets of the United States government so that they could be private entities. They're even called government-sponsored enterprises. We saw what happened in September 2008. The conservatorship is ongoing. I think what the focus of the reform should be is how do you once and for all design a credibility commitment by the government that says, yes, it's true, we played an outsized role in creating these things, but we're done. We're out of the business of backstopping them. If you can answer that question, then you're going to be able to command a big consulting rate when you advise the Eurozone, when you talk about Greece, when you talk to the Fed, when we want to think about a failure of J.P. Morgan Chase, and other places where governmental credibility commitments are very easy to shout from the rooftops, but very hard to implement at the time of crisis.
Yes, my name is Chip Filson. I've worked with credit unions for 35 years. All of the regulatory agencies assert independence, administrative and political independence, is fundamental to their proper functioning. In the banking industry, that is somewhat emphasized by having three separate liquidity, chartering, supervision, and insuring functions. However, in the credit union system, all of those functions are under a single board, under a single administrative structure that continues to assert its independence. The new chair of the Fed has said that her number one priority as the administrator is accountability and transparency. What would you recommend should be structural or legislative change so the completely independent functions of some agencies are subject to some accountability and transparency that's not their own judgment, because their most sensitive decisions are the ones that they do not want to disclose or make available?
I guess I would challenge the premise that these agencies are completely unhinged. I think that I'll give you two kind of examples of the incentives that I think face these regulatory agencies. If we look at the SEC on the one hand or the FDIC on the other, they're highly incentivized. I don't necessarily like the incentives that they're responding to, but they're definitely responding to incentives. At the SEC, every year they say, you can judge, in effect, if you look at their congressional testimony, or you look at their annual report, you can judge us by how many enforcement actions we brung and how much we've collected in fines. And they set themselves out, and Congress has basically accepted this in their oversight capacity as the metrics by which to judge the SEC, which I think has led to a lot of unfortunate consequences. Look at the FDIC. They say, well, let's look at the size of the FDIC insurance fund, the size of the bank insurance fund, and let's look at how many bank failures there are. They're responding to incentives. They're engaged in an ongoing dialogue with Congress and with the public, and this is sort of the received wisdom. So if we look for incentives, these bureaucracies are definitely responding to incentives. We just, I don't think, maybe paying sufficient attention to what those incentives are and how we might alter them or honestly evaluate them and maybe make them a little bit more nuanced or sophisticated. But I do think that these bureaucracies are responding in rational ways to the set of incentives that they either create for themselves or convince Congress are the appropriate metrics by which to evaluate them.
Paul, anything to add, Paul or Peter?
Owen Sheehan, UVA Law alumni. Can the panel comment on both the wisdom and the legal implications of the Fed using its balance sheet to address economic downturns?
So legally, I think there are a few interesting wrinkles. Law had a profound effect on the nature of the Fed's change in its balance sheet. To those who don't follow this, the Fed's balance sheet, I would put that in quotes almost because it doesn't look like anyone else's balance sheet, in part because its liabilities are Federal Reserve notes. I could write you a note and you go try to buy something with it. It's not going to work very well, right? But the Fed's liabilities are those notes that you either carry in your wallet or purse or have digital access to. And that managing that balance sheet, all right, so if its liabilities are the medium that we of exchange, then what are its assets? And historically, going deep into history, that has we've seen a lot of variety what central banks use. Paul mentioned this earlier. It could be, it had been at the Fed's creation, self-liquidating short-term commercial bills, right? Banks lending to others. And after 1955 or thereabouts, we launched an experiment that lasted about 60 years, which was we just use in our central banking assets just short-term government liabilities, right? And then after 2008, that changed. So we had a balance sheet again of about $800 billion, and that blew up half an order of magnitude, over $4 trillion. And that consisted not just of the government short-term bills, but also mortgage-backed securities in a huge quantity. Why? Well, because the law forbids the Fed from doing virtually anything else. So it can't do what the Bank of Japan has done, which is buy equities or buy debt of companies. It can't do what the ECB, it doesn't have the same freedoms that the ECB does to buy other countries' debt. It can only buy, and there's a list designated, it's one of the most specific provisions of the Federal Reserve Act. So legally, the Fed was following the law. Should the law be changed so it's not quite so distortive into one single market? I think that there's a good argument that it should be. Now then, so that's the legal answer. The wisdom of this, I mean, how much time do you have, right? This is one of the dominant debates about what's happening at the Fed today. How do you return not just normalize interest rates so they're at their historical level, but how do you normalize a balance sheet? Do you want to? Or is this balance sheet actually a mechanism, a permanent mechanism of monetary policy today? The Fed has been all over the map on this, but it looks like the large balance sheet may be here to stay.
I would just add that the Fed is not immune from the law of unintended consequences. So when the Fed dramatically increased the size of its balance sheet, because it's increasing the size of its assets, it's increasing the size of its liabilities, which include the excess reserves that banks are holding. Because those excess reserves balloon to such an unprecedented level, the Fed became concerned that it needed to sterilize them, in other words, make sure that they didn't end up resulting in inflation. So it began paying interest on those reserves. And then that has the consequence of making the conduct of monetary policy much more complicated, because it's going to be hard to bring down rates if you're paying extremely high interest on those excess reserves. So that's just a way of saying, you know, everything has unintended consequences, and I'm sure the Fed thought through some of these, but it's having a hard time dealing with all of them.
Let me mention very briefly, as we wait the next question, a free advertisement for Chairman Powell's most recent transparency initiative. He's invited, in an informal way — this isn't administrative law public comment — but an informal way, an invitation an initiative headed by the vice chairman for the Fed, Richard Clarida, to examine exactly these kinds of questions. Go to the bottom and say, are we doing this the right way? The reason that the Fed's balance sheet is here to stay, at least for now, is because it dramatically changed monetary policy in 2008, such that the interest on excess reserves is the primary monetary policy tool. Federal funds rate is secondary. Should that stay? Well, if it stays, it's going to need a big balance sheet to do it. And that's what they're reexamining. So watch this space, or watch their space, really, because in June of this year, they're supposed to have a big public conference where these kinds of debates are being had. Grab whatever mechanism you have, whatever bullhorns at your ready, if it's Twitter or a blog or a letter to the editor, whatever. If you have views on this, you should weigh in, because the Fed is examining this. That doesn't happen very often in history, and it's happening in 2019.
Thank you. Larry Checo again. But we've talked a lot about policy and politics this morning. But what about people who all this is supposed to benefit? How good should we feel as we the people when we're in an era of reduced regulation on financial institutions who caused this crisis 10 years ago and less protection, consumer protection? We've taken all the teeth out of the consumer CFPB. How good should we feel about where we are now?
I think one area of a common agreement, in a way, is I don't think very many people are particularly happy with where we are right now. It turns out there was recently an MIT survey on this question, particularly with respect to the CFPB, and most people, it turns out, think that agency is failing, both inside of regulatory circles and in private sector circles. I think that the bottom line, in my view anyway, which may be idiosyncratic, but there are a lot of ways to protect consumers. If we think about the way that consumers are protected in the securities market, with the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC Rule 10b-5, anti-fraud rules, anti-churning rules, know-your-customer rules, et cetera, I think they're pretty effective. Not completely effective, but they're pretty effective. And we could have used a model like that in protecting people who are in the market for home mortgages. And we chose not to. We chose to go with a bureaucratic option, which I think is very unsuccessful, and it hasn't protected consumers. And again, I don't think it's a technological problem. We figure out ways to protect some people when we want to. We don't protect other people when we don't want to. I think it's a policy failure.
I think it's also important to note that, again, one of the great unintended consequences in this area is that, in general, the larger and more complex the regulatory system gets, the greater the advantage larger institutions have over smaller ones. And, you know, that's something that has played out throughout our financial history. And I think it's a, you know, it's a lesson that we ignore at our peril.
Ed Weiler again. We talked a little bit about CFPB's, and I just wondered if, is there a concern that we should have for the shadow banking system writ large that maybe no one entity is a problem, because we've structurally done something about the CFPB's, but in the aggregate, to the extent that the Fed doesn't very well control that shadow banking system, how do we grapple with that?
Well, so a legal scholar, Morgan Ricks, has offered one answer to this, which is to say, in effect, we should treat anything that is a runnable debt as if it were a bank deposit. And if you want to get a room full of financial people, both practitioners and economists, worked up, just throw that into the middle of the room, because you again run directly into the trade-off that I identified early on, which is a lot of people will say, "Great, do that, and then you can kiss economic growth goodbye, because you simply won't be producing enough credit for the economy's needs." This is, I mean, anyone I think who says that financial system stability is an easy problem to solve with kind of one magic bullet or another, I would be very skeptical about that.
Peter, go ahead. So you're also putting your finger on one of the big debates that's happening in a transition from the Obama administration to the Trump administration, which is, should financial stability be institution specific, or should it be about activities, right? The Mnuchin Financial Stability Oversight Council, he's Secretary of the Treasury, but also ex officio the chair of that council, has said, now, we shouldn't be in the business of designations of institutions, we should be looking at activities. This is a really interesting debate, but that debate also occurred in 2009 and 2010, and the Congress went on the side of institutions, not activities. So it's a big hole in our statutory framework right now for financial stability. And the Fed has kind of come on the side of activities. They've just started what they announced would be an annual financial stability report. It's a really remarkable document where they identify all kinds of activities that give them trouble or that don't give them trouble as they look at the landscape. And that's all good to know. And I think the disclosure of that, what the Fed sees and letting us see what they see, is good. What do you do now? Right? And I think that's the unfinished business of Dodd-Frank.
The only thing I would add, I would say that the shadow banking system is very big and very frightening. It exists for one reason, and that's because the participants in the shadow banking system are large financial institutions that the market believes are too big to fail and will be bailed out. So they have the equivalent of deposit insurance implicitly and in a kind of government subsidized way. My own view is that we should make it explicit that there is no such government guarantee, and I think the shadow banking system would diminish significantly.
Hi, is this on? Okay, so this gets to your final accounting comment earlier in the retribution, you know, post crisis. Do you think it's effective and fair for what seems to be the playbook with the regulators after the fact is to fine multi-billion dollar fines to the various financial institutions, which seem appropriate because they were the ones that did it, but ultimately the real people paying for that are the shareholders who wind up being pension funds and mutual funds, and very little enforcement in terms of personal liability or negligence against the executives of the companies seem to have come out of the crisis? And I'm just, from a fairness, but also from an effectiveness, do you think more executive accountability and risk of either financial or prison time would wind up preventing these things more effectively than passing on the cost to shareholders through fines?
I'm strongly of the view that these institutional penalties for public corporations are punishing the shareholders, particularly where you see no consequences, not only no jail time, but no diminution in bonuses or no shorter tenure, job tenure for top executives. So I think, I think that that this is a source of great frustration. I believe in the rule of law to the extent that these people have not committed prosecutable crimes, then they shouldn't go to jail. On the other hand, there are lots of sanctions for executives who engage in excessive risk-taking that fall short of jail time in terms of lost bonuses, clawbacks, losing your job, things like that, changes in boards of directors. I think that there's a great deal of frustration, and I feel it myself, frankly, that there were less consequences. I'm kind of in favor of what Paul described as the sort of Andrew Mellon approach. But for that approach to work, the people who are making the decisions are the ones who should face the consequences of those decisions, as opposed to the people who have invested in the companies that have hired the people who make those decisions.
Thank you. And on that note, we now have to wrap up this panel. Thank you very much to all our panelists for a great discussion and to all of you. Thanks to the audience for questions. We now take a half-hour break. We'll reconvene at 1 p.m. for the conversation with Larry Summers. Thank you. Yeah.